Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMattei.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
We are sitting in for Tom Hudson this week to have a little chat about a few of the issues that have been dominating the news this past week. Joining us, as always, some of the area's finest journalists to help us make sense of it all. And, of course, we'd like to hear from you throughout this hour, too, so we're going to be asking for your questions and comments. For some time now, former soccer star David Beckham has had his heart set on building a Major League Soccer stadium at Port Miami. But after a lot of opposition, county officials just pulled the plug on that idea. That happened this week. And now Team Beckham has shifted its attention to a different site. Joining us are reporters Patricia Mazet and Doug Hanks. They cover Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald. It's good to have you both here.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having us.
Patty, you were at the unveiling of this new vision and new location for the soccer stadium. How does it look?
Well, it's smaller in scale. You know, the stadium that they're talking about is 20,000 seats instead of 25,000, at least for now. You know, in the future, the plans could always change, certainly add a double deck if it's successful, things like that. And what's really going to lead to a lot of debate here is what it does to Museum Park, which is where the art museum just opened and the science museum is under construction. The park itself hasn't really opened to the public yet. It's supposed to have green space and a shady tree grove and a plaza leading up to this boat slip. And, you know, there's 4 acres of that that are going to go away. The Beckham team says, well, we're going to add a net of 4 other acres along the water, so this is a win. But there's going to be a lot of debate on that, I think.
Okay. And Beckham's real estate advisor, he goes by the name of John Alschuler. He, at the unveiling of the boat slip, he told the audience, mostly journalists yesterday, that downtown Miami really needs this project. Here's what he said.
This is what Museum Park can never be without this intervention. A grand sweep of abundant acreage along a great bay.
Okay, along a great bay, lovely. But whenever we build these sorts of things, I mean, how much of the great bay is still going to be seen?
Well, from the street, a stadium would certainly block most of the views because it would be longwise, parallel to Biscayne Boulevard. So the longer side of the stadium would be along the street, which blocks off, obviously, a significant amount of the new green space that would be created if they fill this slip. Okay. His argument was the city doesn't have enough money to invest in the park as originally intended, so here we come to help them out.
And Patty, a new wrinkle that we're learning about this week is that the University of Miami football program might be interested in using the stadium. Does that, you know, those of us who love soccer know that soccer stadiums and football stadiums are very different animals. Is this the deal enhancer or a deal monkey wrench?
Well, they've been in talks about that since the port site. The issue there would be the size. UM would like 40,000 seats. Soccer, especially Major League Soccer, you know, 20,000 seats,
right,
is about half the size. So politically, certainly UM has a lot of capital with local officials who like to help their local universities when they can. But in terms of size and scheduling and parking, those are the issues that would have to be worked out.
Okay. And this boat slip, forgive my naivete, it's presumably underwater?
It is, in fact, water.
Okay, so when we're looking at costs, how much is it going to cost to dry this place out and make it a soccer stadium?
The county estimates that filling the slip would cost between like $20, $23 million, filling the whole thing. It's about 9 acres of land if you fill it all. The Beckham team said yesterday that they expect the whole project would cost about the same as it would have at the port, which is about $250 million that they would put in. They also are going to apply for a state subsidy to help them out.
Okay. And at yesterday's event, here's what they said about funding.
There will be no city funds.
We don't plan to use any government, any city.
At no cost to the taxpayer.
Any county money to build our stadium.
There will be no county funds.
Doug Hanks, it seems to me we've heard that song before. Okay, is that realistic?
Well, it's realistic. Remember, they are seeking state tax dollars, and they are seeking county land. There is value there. But yeah, that's accurate. They're certainly not going to get public dollars for construction. They've already taken that off the table. It'd be very hard to put it back. But remember, Mayor Jimenez has said it again and again, they will pay fair market rent. Now, that was the port conversation, but that has continued, correct?
The conversation now is if this whole land swap would happen, and so the county would own the stadium land, that Beckham's folks would make a payment, which would you know, be rent of sorts. But what Jimenez would like to do is turn over that money to the city of Miami for parks, maintenance, and operation.
Okay, now the original Port Miami site, that came under fierce opposition from this consortium of cruise interests. So if anybody opposes to this, you know, Doug is going,
Well, from Royal Caribbean. I mean, that was who was driving the train, and they won. I mean, if that was a real effort by David Beckham to get the port and nothing else, RCL won on that.
Okay, so this new site, the boat slip, who would object to this?
Well, so far, I think the loudest voice has been former Miami Mayor Manny Diaz, who was around for the whole fight to create Museum Park in the first place. That fight happened in part because the Marlins at the time were seeking a ballpark on the water. And, you know, they created this park. They put museums on the water. That was controversial. They promised to keep green space. And the zoning, everything was done so that a stadium couldn't go there. And that would all have to change, obviously, if the current Miami City officials and the voters wish to do so.
Okay, we're going to reach out to our listeners now. This is your show, too, so please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN. Also, please go to WLRN.org to take part in the live chat. Find out what others are saying about the news this week. Doug and Patty, it seems that a lot of the sports action this week was not on the gridiron or on the baseball diamond, but in the boardroom. Miami-Dade and the Miami Heat reached a deal about the Heat's tenancy at the American Airlines Arena. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We had three teams this week basically reaching deals with Mayor Carlos Jimenez.
We're now sports reporters.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's kind of a coincidence. Has that struck me? Is there something in the Gatorade or is this all related?
I wouldn't call it a coincidence because remember, as one team sees another team starting to get a handout or getting help from the government, they say, wait a minute, we want our, how's this going to mess up our deal? So I'm not sure the timing is as random as you might think. And they're all related. But the Heat, right now, they play obviously in a government-owned arena that they finance construction on. But they're being paid back through profits that otherwise would be shared with Miami-Dade County. And that profit-sharing agreement famously has only delivered about $270,000 to Miami-Dade after 14 years.
Okay, let me stop you right there. Why did it take so long to discover that this just wasn't profitable for them?
Well, you know, it was a complicated deal. And I think at the time it was not focused on that they would be paid back from their original construction investment out of profits, which is a huge, huge chunk. They also are allowed to pay themselves back for past shortfalls for any year when they couldn't pay themselves back for construction. And just as a result of the deal, it's gotten much harder. Now, LeBron James arrived, sales surged, it got a lot easier to turn a profit. And in fact, last year, there was a very small check written to Miami-Dade County. And while there's no profit heading towards the county, there's lots of money heading from the county to the Heat because the original deal has a $6.4 million operating subsidy paid out of hotel taxes. Mickey Arison said, I want to stay in this arena longer. I want to renegotiate the deal. And what Mayor Jimenez has agreed to is we're going to keep here for five more years. Arison asked for 10. But we'll keep here for five more years with a higher subsidy. And says 6.4 will be 8.5. What the Heat will do is pay $1 million to the Parks Department, not directly to the county, and in the profit-sharing agreement, which both sides are portraying as a concession by the Heat, we don't really know if there would be large profits shared in future years.
Okay. And on the line, we've got a call from Guillermo from Miami. He's got a question about economic studies pertaining to the soccer stadium. Guillermo, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Thank you, sir.
I am interested in finding out which one of the two proposals, the Museum Park or the David Beckham Park, would benefit the economy of South Florida better. And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
I have my thought.
Well, I mean, it's not like anyone has done a study, really. It's moved quickly enough that nobody really looked at it.
Well, I would say this. The soccer team has been very adamant that they will only be playing there 20 days out of the year and has really gone out of their way, I think, to say that otherwise it will not be causing much disruption or much activity. The museums are certainly open 365 days out of the year. So I just think when it comes to spending, How could it not? How could the museums not be having
certainly because there's nothing on the southwest corner of the port that people could go to, at least right now, from a stadium, you know, from a soccer game. They'd have to go into downtown, and some people may choose would choose not to, presumably.
Okay, Doug, a second ago you talked about all three, the triple whammy here, the Twi-Night doubleheader. I'm terrible with sports terms, but not to be left out, it looks like the owner of the Miami Dolphins is throwing in the towel in his push for a property tax break on Sun Life Stadium. So what are Stephen Ross and Miami-Dade County negotiating now?
Well, earlier this year, Steve Ross said to Miami-Dade County, listen, will you take over ownership of the stadium? I'll finance privately a $350 million renovation, and what I'll get out of the deal is relief from property tax. That apparently was not going to get done. It's unclear whether or not the Dolphins pulled it back or they pulled it back because of opposition. But now there's a new plan, which is I'll privately finance the renovation. All I want is bonus payments from Miami-Dade County when I bring in a major event, including Super Bowl, which is the one everyone thinks of, World Cup soccer, which may come someday, international soccer, which is already here, and concerts. Jay-Z comes to town. There should be a little payment from Miami-Dade County for the associated spending. And I think the way to look at this deal is, first of all, we don't know how much money it will cost the public because the prices have not been revealed. But the NFL provides a financing program for stadiums and allows owners, if they build a stadium, to borrow money for the NFL and pay it back with money they would otherwise pay to league headquarters. So in a way, it's free money.
Right.
But for whatever reason, the NFL requires public dollars to be in a stadium deal to qualify for that money. And so Steve Ross needs that public component.
But Doug, does this particular deal, though, seem to indicate that the public as a whole has reached a threshold when it comes to the demands that are put on the taxpayer for these kinds of deals?
I think absolutely. I think you see the evolution of the Dolphins deal over the last 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. reflecting that trend, which is nationwide. It is much harder to get these stadium deals done. The Marlins did not help, but just nationwide you're seeing it. And that's one of the reasons people think that the Heat came now to get their deal as opposed to waiting. I mean, it helps that LeBron James is here,
right.
But 5 years, that the deal that's proposed now would be much harder to get. That's what people who follow stadium financing think.
Okay, we're going to take a little break, still to come. Improvements to Miami's port have cost a bundle, but will taxpayers see a return on their investment? Plus, lifestyles of the rich and hypocritical. That's up next on the Florida Roundup.
That's the sound of the finishing touches being put on the new Port Miami Tunnel, which officially opened this week, but not really. I'm Tim Padgett.
And I'm Christine DiMatte.
And welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. The billion-dollar tunnel is the new jewel of Port Miami's $2 billion expansion, which is largely aimed at taking advantage of the increased cargo traffic coming through an expanded Panama Canal. But now that the project is just about finished, the big question is, will it deliver the economic benefits it advertised? Here with us again are Doug Hanks and Patricia Mazze of the Miami Herald. Your questions are also welcome for the panel. Email us with your first name and location to the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. You can call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can tweet us at @WLRN. And we have our live blog, where you can join us online, join the online discussion on our website, WLRN.org. Doug, Patty, actually, I should correct myself. The big question is, when can the trucks finally get in the tunnel and get out of downtown traffic?
Won't be long now.
I hope you're right, because I'm tired of eating exhaust from Mack trucks on Northeast 2nd Avenue. But obviously, the big question here is when will taxpayers begin to see the port recouping the multi-billion-dollar investment that's been made in this expansion? The port has claimed that we're going to see a vast increase in port revenues as a result of the expansion at the canal, which also includes, aside from the tunnel, dredging and skyscraper-sized cranes to accommodate these larger post-Panamax ships that will be coming, that the port canal accommodate. But what are the prospects, in your opinion, of us seeing this dramatic increase in revenues at the port as a result of this expansion anytime soon?
I mean, that is really the number one question facing the port is, will this bet, this huge investment in cranes and dredging, pay off in future cargo revenue once someday the Panama Canal is widened? Now, the tunnel is a convenience factor. It should ease some traffic issues at the port, but it's a big help to downtown Miami to get those trucks out of there. But Port Miami has spent so much money. Their debt, it's a county agency, but it has its own sort of debt structure. Debt is topping $1 billion this year. It's been downgraded twice by Moody's. Just this month, they had to take some unfavorable terms on bonds. And frankly, one of the reasons that David Beckham had such a hard time at Port Miami is the finances. And you had the port bureaucracy saying, do not give him that land. We need that land to bring in all this commercial real estate to generate some dollars.
Right.
To sort of ease this squeeze that's here and is going to get worse.
And unwittingly, they kind of brought a new wave of opposition to their plans to bring in some of those dollars, because they want to build high-rises there that would compete with downtown. And so that's why there were downtown interests who wanted a stadium there, because they said, get that money that you know you can get from a stadium, that you can get it now before, you know, these ideas of having sky-rises could take years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you won't be competing with the open space we still have downtown for rentals.
And I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said at the beginning, you know, that this is a taxpayer burden. Can you? Or,
it is a taxpayer.
It is.
It's not
solely
taxpayer
a taxpayer. But what I was asking was, could you then help us understand what is the financing structure of this huge expansion?
Well, yes. I mean, most of it is coming from cruise and cargo fees. At the port. That's what most of the debt is backed by.
It's a self-sustaining agency in that sense.
Right.
But wait a minute, before we go forward, mm-hmm. There was $100 million borrowed against property taxes to pay for the tunnel, and taxes are backing up the debt. So, I mean, that is the question, is if there's a squeeze, if there's some crisis that affects cruise traffic, et cetera, what's the exposure to Miami-Dade County itself? It's already $100 million in debt for the tunnel. But it, you know.
And when I was recently in Panama, the head of the Panama Canal Authority, Jorge Quijano, was adamant that we're going to see an increase in post-Panamax vessel cargo traffic coming in and out of this hemisphere to the tune of, say, from 320 million tons now to between 500 and 600 million tons over the course of the next decade. Is that kind of increase in cargo coming through this hemisphere going to be enough then to help a port like Miami realize its ambitions?
That's the big question. There's two camps. One says Miami is perfectly positioned for this, and it's going to get great investment coming back to it for decades because it invested early. Others say, listen, other ports will catch up, the market will take over, and there's an economic reason to keep those ships going north towards the population centers of the East Coast, rather than stopping here and having to deal with transporting goods over land. So,
but experts disagree. But
we
right and exactly, and we have skeptics who say that no, it's still better, it's still more profitable and efficient to have all this cargo coming in, say from Asia, at ports on the West Coast, and then sending them through by rail. As you were mentioning before, Doug, Moody's, the credit rating agency, is questioning whether Port Miami can really realize the recouping of investment that it claims. And this is what Moody's analyst Myra Shanken had to say about that.
We're not sure that there's going to be a big shift in cargoes from the West Coast to the East Coast due to the opening of the Panama Canal. And the reason why we think that is because if you look at the cargo transit times from Asia to the U.S., if you were to put a box on a boat from Shanghai to Long Beach and then transfer it to rail, it's still quicker to get to the East Coast than it would be using the all-water service through the Panama Canal.
So what realistically are the broader economic gains that South Floridians should expect from the Port Miami expansion?
Well, listen, one of the reasons that the recession wasn't as horrible as it could have been in Miami, and it was horrible, was the international sector, is that we were so tied to Latin American economies that were sort of countercyclical, that were resisting the recession. And you saw decent numbers related to trade and cargo. But it takes a government-supported port for this to happen. You know, it's not going to survive just on its own. So that's what's required, is you got to keep that port competitive to have these private sector industries doing okay.
Mm-hmm. Patty?
I think Doug wrapped it up well. I mean, I don't think we know the answer yet. I mean, it's going to be many years, and it is a bet that the port made, and the state made it with them. You know, they said, yes, we believe in your tunnel and we believe in this plan and we're going to move forward. But right now they're feeling a little bit of the strain of it. And I think they will for the foreseeable future until we see whether it plays out in their favor.
Patricia Mazet and Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald, as always, thanks for your expert insights. Remember, you can join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576, or tweet us at callsign at WLRN. And we have our live blog where you can join the online discussion on our website, WLRN.org. I'm Tim Padgett.
And I'm Christine DeMattei.
And speaking of wealth in Miami, we learned some astonishing things this week about Venezuela's so-called socialist millionaires. According to El Nuevo Herald, Venezuelan entrepreneurs Raul Gorin and Gustavo Perdomo own $4 million homes in Coral Gables. They drive Ferrari and Maserati sports cars. They spend tens of thousands of dollars at swank stores like Gucci. The problem? They also claim to be committed allies of the socialist Bolivarian revolution that rules Venezuela, which supposedly condemns the self-indulgent excesses of the rich. Joining us now is El Nuevo Herald reporter Antonio Delgado, who wrote this week's eye-opening article about Gorin and Perdomo. Antonio, as you point out, their crony ties to the socialist government in Caracas worry many because they are also the new owners of the Venezuelan news network Globovisión.
Actually, yes. They purchased Globovisión back in 2013, and since then the channel took a radical change in its editorial line, forcing a lot of journalists to step down to go on to unemployment because they could not continue reporting the news as they would like to.
But we should also point out, Antonio, that the sale of Globovisión was necessitated because the socialist government of the late President Hugo Chavez persecuted, I guess is the best word, or just put the squeeze for so many years on Globovisión through costly fines and arbitrary regulatory sanctions, because Globovisión happened to be one of the last TV networks in Venezuela that was critical of the socialist revolution.
Yes, they did. Actually, it seemed for years that the Hugo Chavez government wanted to close down Globovisión. They opened a couple of big cases in court, trying to force them out. And there are many references Hugo Chavez made that he wanted to close them because he felt that they were part of the enemies of the so-called Bolivarian revolution.
But in fairness, we should point out, though, that one of the reasons that Hugo Chavez went after Globovisión so hard was that in 2002, it openly backed a short-lived coup against Chavez, and that's one of the bases of that bitterness between Chavez and Globovisión.
Yeah, that's a big accusation. One of the main accusations Chavez had against Globovisión, and also Channel 2, RCTV, which was closed down back in 2005, which was one of the main open signal television stations in Venezuela. Yeah, the coverage that some of these TV stations did back in the 2002 coup could be viewed as slanted. They reported some of the events that led to the crisis in the palace that forced Chavez out, but they did not cover what happened after Chavez was taken out of the palace.
I can tell you, I lived in Venezuela at the time, and I remember what was really astonishing about that day was there was no news for after mm-hmm. a while. For you know, when the TV station stepped in, it was a split screen situation where right. the mm-hmm. government was speaking. And when that happens, it's called la cadena, right? All the stations and all link in by law, they're supposed to show the full screen of the speech that's happening. They split their screens to show the government on one side and the protests on the other side. And after that happened and the government clamped down, there was no news for most of the night. And it was one of the scariest things I've experienced, and probably one of the reasons I'm in journalism, because mm-hmm. they were showing cartoons.
Yeah. And Patty, how long ago was that?
That was in 2002.
2002.
Okay. Antonio, the new owners of Global Vision, they claim to speak for the poor. Am I right?
It's part of the argument, yes.
Okay. But when they come to Miami, how do they live?
Well, they live in style. They live like kings. They have big mansions here. We were able to detect at least two big mansions in Coco Plum, which is a very exclusive area. They purchased those at $3.5 million each. They're valued a little bit more now. I think about around $4.5 million. They drive Ferraris. They drive Maseratis. They have like... between these two businessmen, they own five or six luxury cars each. They travel in private jets. And they were seen last December shopping in Miami. They spent about a month shopping in exclusive shops by purchasing $3,000 jackets and $2,000 hand purses. In contrast to what the population in Venezuela is actually going through right now, which have to spend hours in line to be able to purchase bread or cheese or milk.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Marco Rubio has spoken out strongly about this. The most anybody can do is be indignant. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, he has.
Well, but there are a lot of accusations, though, that there's no way that Gorin and Perdomo could have been able to buy Globovision last year unless they had very, very close ties with the revolution. And is there any proof that those cronyous ties are in any way illicit in the sense that the U.S. Senate is looking at right now? Is there any illicit connection that you know is causing concerns that these guys are not on the up and up?
There have been local reports saying that, yeah, some of it might be linked to corruption, but I haven't seen any hard evidence on that. Other than to say that Gorin is the owner of an insurance company, one of the largest ones in Venezuela,
right,
and that it's getting most of government contracts. So he, he's looked favorably by the Chavismo.
But the bigger issue here, though, is what's known as the bully bourgeoisie, the so-called socialist millionaires who have profited very handsomely from their ties to the revolution. And they are living it up in many ways here in Miami. How big a concern is that? Chris just mentioned Marco Rubio is livid about this, but is there any, again, back to my question, is there anything really here that the United States government can sanction them on?
To be clear, I don't know if the new owners of Global Vision are going to be in the final list that is being discussed in the Senate.
Right.
And I understand that the names in that list are mainly military officials involved directly right. with the crackdown mm-hmm. In Venezuela and corruption cases. Now, I know that some of the people that are involved in drafting that list have vast knowledge of what's going on in Venezuela and have been observing corruption and drug dealing for years in the country.
Mm-hmm. Doug, what do you think about this whole bully bourgeoisie phenomenon here in South Florida?
Well, I don't have anything to add with this panel on that, but I do want to say that that these folks are now officially personas non grata in Miami.
No kidding.
This is an action City of Miami took. It's one of the classic examples of municipal foreign policy that we seem to
see
in South
Florida. It was a total
show
at City Hall yesterday, actually. It drew a bunch of cameras and interest, but it's symbolic, basically. And certainly last time they did this to Nelson Mandela back in the day, it turned into a major boycott of the South Florida economy. I'm not sure that this has that kind of level. But it is a symbolic kind of act by the local elected officials in an election year.
Well, that brings up an important point, though. We have the we have to draw a distinction between people that, for example, we are very heavy right now into sanctions against Russian officials vis-a-vis the Ukraine crisis, going after Russian officials who call the foreign policy shots there with regard to Russia's dealings with Ukraine. But we have to draw a line here, don't we, Antonio, between government officials in Venezuela and business people like Gorin and Perdomo, who, even though their lifestyles might appall us here, in, as we said before, in the sense of the hypocrisy, they claim to be allies of socialism, but can legally, is there really any reason to go after people like them here?
No, if there's not any evidence of wrongdoing. A lot of these businessmen have been benefiting of the currency exchange scheme in Venezuela, which favors a lot of people, and their claims that there has been a lot of corruption coming out of that. Even within from their own Chavismo government, there was a report or a statement made by the planning minister a while back saying that the country might have lost around $20 billion linked to those kind of practices. So there are corrupt businessmen allied with Chavismo. Now, we don't know. We just don't know right now if the new owners of Globovision form part of that class.
Okay. Well, thanks, Antonio, and great article this week.
Thank you, Antonio. Still to come, how much do we know about the people living in Florida's famed River of Grass? A reporter spends months with the last indigenous people living in Florida. That's just ahead. I'm Christine DiMatte. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. What you're listening to, this is an excerpt from a performance at the Miccosukee Resort. It's a traditional dance. Now, it's safe to say that most South Floridians know what the Everglades are, where they are, but sometimes we just tend to forget that there are actually people living there. Joining us now is Chad Gillis. He's a reporter for the News Press. Chad and his photographer, Andrew West, they spent 8 months on a series called Voices of the Everglades, and that series explores in depth the lives of the Seminole and Miccosukee tribal members, as well as the so-called traditional Indians who are not part of any reservation. Chad, it is great to have you on.
Thank you for having me today.
Also with us is Leroy Osceola. Fascinating history here. He is a seventh generation son of the famed Seminole chief Osceola. Leroy, great to have you on too.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Now, Chad, what motivated you to begin this series? You and I spoke earlier and you said that it happened by accident. What happened?
It did happen by accident. Andrew and I were out in the Everglades and we got lost. And oddly enough, we're not far from Leroy's home, we found out about a year later. And we were out there, and we saw houses, we saw some, chiquis and other things, and we didn't realize that there were people there. So we thought, why not let the people who live in the Everglades tell us what it is instead of outside people trying to define it? Why not go back to the most original source that we have in the area, which is the natives?
Okay, Chad, perfect example of a bit of a disconnect between the Miccosukee and Seminoles and everybody else is you just said chiqui. Now, all this time, I'm living in South Florida 18 years. I thought it was chiqui.
I think chiqui is right.
Leroy, is that right?
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. People know what you mean.
And what is it exactly? I mean, it's presumably a place to live. I mean, how is it constructed?
In our language, it means house, chiget. So
okay, the Seminoles still live in the chiqui huts?
Yeah, mostly the traditionals.
And Leroy, who are the traditionals?
We're the same families from the reservation people. We were just divided by reservations when they were formed, and they were separated when people accepted a reservation life and left their camps and joined with the reservation.
Why separate yourself?
I don't know how to explain it, but we've always been here, and people came and tried to tell us who we are and try to change us and take our land and try to eliminate us. So we've always stuck to who we are, and if you go to the reservations, it's a different world over there.
You just said a different world, a world apart. Chad, when you first ventured into this world, as a reporter and with your photographer, how hard was it to establish trust?
It was very difficult, understandably so. It wasn't until the third day that old man George Billy, he's 86 now, spoke to me. I talked to him. The first two trips, I drove out to the reservation. I hiked a mile in the swamp in the summertime, and George was tending a fire at the Panther Clan camp. And I would sit down and talk to him, and he would just look at me like I was some sort of little pixie flying around or a mosquito or something. And he wouldn't say anything, and I would go on and elaborate about my life and my family and where I live and these things. And he would just look at me, and he never said a word. And finally, on the third trip, he opened up and started to explain things to me. And I asked him if he could help me with this project, and he said of course he could. He called himself the Big Wheel. He said he could make anything happen. And oddly, after it wasn't with a matter of days within meeting George and having that encounter that all these other doors started opening up. And I don't know if that was just coincidental or if he really is the Big Wheel.
Okay. Now, Chad, when we talk about in the Everglades, actually dwelling there, how many square miles did you cover? Where are these villages?
Well, the Everglades and Big Cypress covers about 2 million square miles. And the villages are located, some are along Tamiami Trail near the Miami-Dade Collier County line. There are some in Immokalee. There are some near Clewiston. There are some on the East Coast, and there are some in Brighton as well. Leroy probably knows a little bit more about this than me.
Okay. You know, we reached out to members of the Public Insight Network, Native American, people with Native American backgrounds. We asked them to weigh in about what were the biggest misconceptions about them in mainstream America. Here's what they had to say.
I am a citizen of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. One of the misconceptions about Native Americans is Native Americans in this country gets all types of free benefits from the U.S. government.
I believe one of the biggest misconceptions that Floridians have about Native Americans is that we don't pay taxes. In all honesty, we do pay taxes. We are just like everybody else.
Now, that was Samuel Tommy from Clewiston and Neom Friday. She used to live in Miami and is now living in California. This is a question for both of you, Chad and Leroy. Where do you think that misconception comes from, that Seminole and Miccosukee don't pay taxes? Where is that coming from?
I think it stems back from the early settlement days. I've read accounts where the logic for taking natives' land was they weren't Christian. And only Christian people could own land. Only, you know, God would only set aside land for ownership for Christian people. And if they weren't Christian, then it was okay to take whatever lands they were living on. So I think it stems back from that time.
Leroy, where do you think that misconception comes from?
I think in reality, like if you buy gas or clothes, we pay taxes that way, like everybody else, but the reservations, they weren't paying taxes on gaming revenue. But recently, the IRS came back in and started getting it. So you would have to ask them to explain that part.
Chad and Leroy, one question I have is, in my work in Latin America, I've spent a lot of time with tribes like the Yanomami in Venezuela, who have also made, you know, a very earnest point of separating themselves, as you were saying earlier, from even reservation life. And one of the things I found is that, you know, on the one hand, there is a lot of positives to this, you know, the very pristine natural life that they're living. But on the other hand, in the 21st century, you have concerns about the negatives of isolation for some of these groups. Is that a concern for you out in the Everglades as well, that on the one hand, you are living a very healthy, pristine, natural life, but on the other hand, are there any drawbacks or negatives to the isolation that you may be creating for yourselves?
No, not at all. We prefer it that way because you don't come in contact with all the diseases and all the bad ways of other people.
I think Leroy and some others would probably not interact with the outside world as much as they do, and they're forced to now. You know, Leroy has to drive a truck to go into town to get groceries and to buy things for his family. And years ago, 30, 40, 50 years ago, even that recently, that wasn't the case. People like Leroy could go out and they could fish and they could hunt. They could make their own clothes and they could get their medicine from the land. Now they can't go and harvest plants and animals in Everglades National Park anymore in places like that because the federal government has made it illegal. So in some cases, their lifestyle has now become illegal over these years, and thereby they're forced to engage the outside world even at times when they don't want to.
Okay, and Chad, another area in which the outside world is inevitably engaged is the area of Everglades restoration. What do the Miccosukee and Seminole feel is going on with that? Do they feel it's going far enough, it's doing enough?
Well, I think there are a lot of people in South Florida in favor of restoration, and I found that to be the case with the reservations as well as the traditionals. They want to see clean water. They want to see things restored to a more natural order. You know, they want to be able to eat the food that they ate before instead of having to turn to, you know, fast food alternatives and processed sugars and things like that. They sweeten drinks and food and things with guava and honey. And fruit and things like that. They weren't exposed to sugar until, you know, some people until the 1950s, 1960s. So
it's had a profound effect on their health.
Oh, yeah. I've seen people, I'm 40, and I've seen people much younger than me with both legs amputated from diabetes. And that part of it's really sad.
Leroy, this is for you. How many South Floridians can live their entire lives without any meaningful contact with Seminole or Miccosukee people? How would you go about changing that, or would you even want to change that?
Yeah, well, in a lot of ways, today is we have to because our environment is being destroyed and polluted. So people need to understand that. In our view, the native view, the traditional view, this is our country. We don't see it as America. So people need to understand that and understand that there's people here before them, and the land has to be preserved, and the environment has to be preserved, and everything else has to be preserved. That's what people need to understand and accept. That's the only way they will preserve the future for their own generations, not just for us.
Leroy Osceola, thanks for spending some time with us today. The title of the series is Voices of the Everglades. Wonderful work by News Press reporter Chad Gillis. And you can find it at news-press.com. Chad, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, the Memorial Day weekend is upon us. Unofficial start of summer, lots of picnics and music and things, but let's talk for a second about what it really means, can we please? Memorial Day weekend, we want to take a moment to recognize those who have died while in military service. And WLRN-TV will be rebroadcasting its documentary next week on Jewish Floridians who have served in the armed forces. The film is called A Call to Serve, Florida Jews and the U.S. Military. And in this excerpt, you're going to hear from Erwin Stavrov. He flew two missions on D-Day. When he jumped from a plane and landed on the front lines, he had to toss his dog tags. Those dog tags indicated an H for Hebrew.
We flew two missions on D-Day. The channel was nothing but boats, ships, everything you could think of, men. So we looked down and you could see it. They must have known really that we were coming because they hit us real hard. They hit our number one and number two engine. The hydraulic system failed. There was flame starting to come into the cabin itself. So we got our chutes on and everybody started to bail out. After floating, which seemed like an hour, I fell to the ground. I knew the Germans were there because we were in the front lines.
Joining us now is the filmmaker, Steve Waxman. Steve.
Hi.
So good to have you on.
Thanks.
Steve, when did you begin working on this film?
Oh, I think in, well, there was a lot of pre-production going on. The exhibit at the Florida Jewish Museum was back in 2010 and 11. So I went in there and really was compelled by what I saw and started to shoot a lot of the artifacts in the hope that it would be someday made into a documentary. And then when I came to WLRN, they were gracious enough to fund it, and then it became a reality. So on and off since about 2011.
I'm the daughter of a leatherneck Marine, God rest him. He served in World War II. And I have to tell you, I tried to track down some of my dad's old platoon mates. Lamentably, not many left alive. So how difficult was it for you to find people for this documentary?
It wasn't difficult to find them, believe it or not. What was challenging was to get the piece done before they passed on. And that was really, that became a focus after a while. I wanted to make sure that all of these guys and women who were in the piece saw it before, you know, nature took its course. And unfortunately, only one person didn't make it, Arnold Schwartz, who died 3 months after I made the piece. But his daughter came to the premiere, and she said to me, I'll never forget it, she said, thank you for showing me in his last form of being strong and viable, because she only remembered the 3 months in which he had sort of dissipated and gone down in health. But this film reminded her of the strong man that he was, and it was, you know, how much more touching can that be than to hear that? So that was quite a compliment.
And you just said a moment ago, Jewish service women, too. So give us the most harrowing tale told by a woman in this documentary.
Well, I think,
without any spoilers, of course.
No, Jeanette Jacobson, she was she volunteered and she was, I guess, part of the AWAC or the service sector at that point. Anyway, she wound up in London in the planning headquarters of Eisenhower. So she was privy to the D-Day bombings, and she also witnessed firsthand the bombings on London. And that was quite harrowing to be, you know, part of that. And she had nothing but great admiration for the people of England during those bombings, how they held up and slept in their tubes and things like that.
Steve, one of the things that struck me about the stories that I heard in this documentary was a sort of a sense of urgency on the part of many in the Jewish community that, you know, joining in the fight in World War II could also be a way to help Jews receive more acceptance in mainstream American life. And many African Americans have said the same thing about military service, especially in World War II. How important was that aspect of this, do you think?
Well, it played a role, but I think you hit the key point. It's the universality of the film. I mean, all minorities and all immigrants like to show that they're as patriotic to America as each other are. So by them joining the military, yes, it gave them an opportunity to show that they love the country, but they joined it specifically because they felt the country had been so good to them and allowing them to prosper in so many ways that they wanted to pay back with loyalty and patriotism.
And Steve, one last question very quickly, and then we've got to go. If every filmmaker looks back at their film and goes, oh gosh, I wish I had done this. Any regrets, anything that you wanted to get in that you just couldn't get in?
You know what? Based on the time, I'm happy, believe it or not. Maybe 5 years I won't be as happy, but I'm happy now.
Joining us was filmmaker Steve Waxman. His work, A Call to Serve, Florida Jews and the U.S. Military. You can watch that full documentary on Thursday, May 29th on Channel 17. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Florida Roundup for Friday, May 23rd, 2014. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And we post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. And we have a whole lot of other credits that I've lost right now. And let's see if I can rattle this off the top of my head. Paul Leary, who is nodding to me, he is our tech. And Elaine Chen was our producer. Elaine Chen was our producer. Our program director is Peter Mayers. I'm Christine DiMatte.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
Tom Hudson is back next week. Coming up next, we have got South Florida Arts Beat. This has been the Florida Roundup. And we will see you next week.